The American poet James Russell Lowell lived through most of the 19th century. He was part of a group called the Fireside Poets, and for a while they ran head-to-head with the famous British Romantic poets of the 19th century. He was also the ambassador to the Court of St. James in London at one time. In a poem called Above and Below, James Russell Lowell writes this: O dwellers in the valley land, who in deep thought grope and cower till the slow mountain's dial hand shorten to noon's triumphant hour, while you sit idle, do you think the Lord's great work sits idle too? That light dare not o'erleap the brink of morn because all is dark with you? The Lord wants reapers. Oh, mount up before night comes and says, too late! Stay not for taking scripture or cup. The master hungers while you wait. 'Tis from these heights alone your eyes, the advancing spears of day, can see that o'er the eastern hilltops rise to break your long captivity. The battle in every culture is over the theme of by what vision shall we live? By what vision shall we live? Some even speak of a vision quest. We've lost that to some extent in our modern North American culture, but in past generations, in past centuries, the vision quest idea has been a strong one. Aboriginals for millennia would go as young men into the forest and wait there in silence, alone, for the voice of their totem animal. And Aboriginals in Australia would walk the red hills in the far distance of the outback until their spirit came to them. An unseen world would rise through the power of mescaline and the dance and the trance around fires in Latin and South America. In Europe, news of Excalibur, the magical sword drawn from a stone by the chosen one, or rising from the mystery of a lake in the hands of a beautiful lake princess to be given to the person of the hour. The quest for the Holy Grail, the healing of the wounded Fisher King, when he has his arrow taken from the wound that has ruined the world, he and the world begin to heal. The summer solstice celebrations at Stonehenge, which have taken place this very week, and spring seen to return by the recovering of a dismembered goddess who has been dragged underground by the spirits of winter. There it is, the haunting tale of a vision quest lying just below the surface. They come from a deep place. They come from our desire at best to grasp the truths we deeply know, or at worst, to deny those truths. The battle goes on in our culture. And David and Goliath is such a tale. It is about a vision quest at root. The hero of the quest faces the enemy that denies the quest, and in seeing them do it, we lean in and we learn things about our own life experience. There is no quest, shouts the enemy. There is only conquest, he says. Well, it's good to know that we have an armed host standing with us if we're going to brave this thing. Saul and his troops are standing nearby. They may be quaking at the knees at the sight of the Philistines and Goliath standing before them, but at least they're there. And we have strength at our place, too. We have the anchorage of great law, if we will allow the law to speak, and we have the power of mercy, if we will be merciful, and we have a sense of justice, if we will let justice fill our sails, and we have hard-won civil rights, if anyone remembers them, and we have the love and support around our real lives from those who love us, if we let it in, and we have our own hard-won victories, too, by which we know something of our own strength and something of the human potential and something of the goal towards which we are walking. Still, the money seems to be on Goliath, isn't it? If I were to check the balance between quest and restriction down the centuries, it would lean heavily towards restriction, I think. It's easier and safer to accept what we're given and to live within the fences set before us normal is normal, someone says, and we simply believe them. And the expected is what's to be expected, they say, and we simply believe them. Self-serving morality and social blandness make it much easier for living. Let's release prejudice and injustice out into the front yard to keep strange people from coming knocking at our door, asking for more than we're willing to give. The pattern across time, and we know it well, is that the powerful call the shots, the rich make the rules, the systems serve the select ones, the pecking order is mostly retained in the generations after generation after generation. Public order and smooth sailing for the majority seem to mark the day. There is no mercy, there are few exceptions, and there is no major overhaul from one generation to another. Even if a revolution occurs, it seems it is not long before those who were the strongest revolutionaries are now ruling at the top and beginning to suppress those beneath them. There will always be malcontents and fussers, we say, at the bottom of the heap. Let them fuss as long as they don't come into our yard or change any of our dreams. It's the same. Well, artistically and historically, David and Goliath in this story is thought to be a product of the spin makers in Solomon's court, David's flamboyant son Solomon. This is a great King David story that they have written. And it gives Solomon street credibility and gravitas. The story says, if this is the gene pool from which Solomon comes, and David was able to slay a giant, well, surely Solomon, in all his glory, will be able to slay all the giants for us. Haven't we got a wonderful king? And in the story, there are two conflicting accounts as to how Goliath actually dies. One says it is purely by divine intervention. One smooth stone in a sling hits the giant between the eyes in his one vulnerable spot, and down he falls. The other says that it comes from a warrior's might, that David stepped forward, took the sword of the giant, and cut off the giant's head. Actually, within the text, there's another little hidden bit if you look for it. It says that somebody else besides David actually killed the giant, one of David's generals, but we don't talk about that too much. The story says that David refused the protection of armor. The writer is saying this will be a divine victory, no armor necessary. God is the armor. The moment is about the quest, and the result is a cosmic accomplishment. So I ask myself, who is Goliath of Gath? Well, he's the consummate warrior. He's the imperial guard dog. He's the one we see touted in all the great new war movies which come down the pike moment after moment in a turbulent world like this. We're all going to be all right, we say, as we sit and eat our popcorn in the dark, as long as we have these Goliaths in front of us on the screen. He's the first and the last line of defense. Goliath mocks any goodness. He names us as unworthy of his time or energy, and he calls our quest for justice a foolish dream. Well, he believes his own propaganda, too, again. Goliath does have weapons and cunning and self-serving immorality. He doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about the meaning of what he's doing, how it affects people in the immediate moment and in their family group and in the next generation and the next down through the years. He doesn't see what it does to the fabric of the nation for whom he fights. He will crush opponents for the sake of national security. There can be no loose strings in it, no cutting edges, no social fabric that doesn't work for those in charge. That's Goliath for you. Well, who's David? David, in my mind, is a triptych. It's a three-panel portrait of a hero, the classic hero. He is Clint Eastwood in High Plains Drifter, riding alone with his hat pulled down over his eyes on a horse along the top of a mesa. He is Errol Flynn in Robin Hood. Welcome to Sherwood. You have no idea what's going to happen to you. And he is also Sylvester Stallone in Rocky. Will he win? Well, he trains. He doesn't have much going for him, but you have a feeling right at the beginning of the movie that things are going to go a different way. He is Joseph, the dreamer, the one who led his people from death, eventually to nationhood. He is Samson, the true story of David, weakened by his kingship over time, but strong as a remembered legendary builder of the greatest empire that Israel ever knew. And in a sense, David is Jesus, an unarmed man on a donkey riding against the might of a prevailing empire. It's all there. Pride Sunday is the Sunday in which the rider rides, the day that an unexpected victory is won. Why is the money always on Goliath? Perhaps it's a faith thing, and I'm not trying to judge myself or others here. Faith is a hard business. It may be that we're not actually sure that good things ever really win, that a good day is an anomaly. It's not a sign of something deeper. Perhaps we're not really sure there is a day of salvation. Oh, it's a dream, and it would be wonderful if all worlds came to that beautiful world, but seeing the world and reading the headlines, we're not exactly sure that a day of salvation is in the cards. And just in case it isn't, we hoard and we protect our parameters and we keep noble words for high and noble occasions just in case the Lord shows up. But in other cases, we keep a pretty close watch on the latch on the door. You remember how furious the prophet Jonah was when God actually showed up in the city of Nineveh, and the great foreign city of Nineveh repented of its ways and turned towards a deeper day of salvation. Jonah was furious. He had his money on Goliath, you see, and he lost it all. The money is on Goliath because it's easier to stay silent and to play the passive supporter than it is to see what we're seeing and to name it for the perversity it is. I unfriended a friend on Facebook this week. I haven't done that for a long time. I'm not on Facebook for political opinions. I'm not on Facebook for the scathing criticism one person gives another. This was a member of the International Clan. I don't know her very well, probably have met her on a couple of occasions. But I was writing things about the perversity of taking children from their parents, the thing we're all talking about at borders and so on. We have the same issue to some extent in Canada. And the writing back from her began to be filled with sarcasm. Oh, I'm sure you do it much better. I'm sure your church is open to everybody. We're going to send 500 of them tomorrow. And the next day when you open the door, there'll be 500 more. But that's okay. You'll be able to handle it. I'll come up and make soup for you, she said. I wrote back to her and I said, your sarcasm is about as unhelpful as my dwelling in the clouds. And therefore, I feel that I just don't need to hear this on my Facebook page. I felt badly about that. But there comes a time when it's necessary to say, there are some things that are far more important, and to trivialize them and to mock them is foolish. It's too easy to stay silent and to be passive, but it's more important to speak. It takes guts to take a stand. Listen to the gauntlet that's being run by the members of the church at Corinth. It's written right there in the text. Great endurance, fighting through hardship and calamity, imprisonment, beatings, riots, labors, sleepless nights, and hunger. That's us. That's our community in the ancient world, in this world, fighting for the things at the heart of faith. It's profoundly difficult to do it. I heard an interview on the CBC the other night with a woman who was part of the Russian band Pussy Riot. Do you remember that a few years ago? This women's band, Pussy Riot, gave a concert in a Russian cathedral in Moscow, and they were arrested for sedition, and they spent time in prison. Now, one of the women has written a play about her experience of being in a Russian prison, and she became connected with people from a play company in Belarus, and they all were able to sneak themselves out of Russia with the KGB or its equivalent right on their tails, and now they're going around the world telling the story of what it's like to be in a Russian prison. The first thing they do, they said, is strip you naked, be you man or woman, and they check all your orifices to start. And that's the beginning of life in a Russian prison. And then it gets worse. She said, my actors put themselves through hell every night in this play. They throw themselves down on the stage. They inflict pain on each other so that those sitting comfortably in the audience will experience in their souls the possible depravity that is in human life and the courage it takes to stand up against it. Well, that's pretty difficult to hear on a crowded street on a ride home after a day's work, isn't it? And how are we to respond, do you think? How difficult is it to respond? It's profoundly difficult to respond. I was reading about the black activist and preacher of the 19th century, Frederick Douglass, the other day. I didn't know much about him. He had a black slave mother and a white slave owner for a father. His mother died when he was 7. His father used to beat him every day and whip him every day. A white woman in the family house took him in and secretly taught him how to read, and then the father forbade it. He opened a small church on the plantation where he lived to teach black men how to read the New Testament. His father shut it down. Finally, when he was 18, the great culmination between the two men came. There was a battle in the front yard. It lasted 2 hours until Frederick Douglass stood over his broken father and was sold to another slave owner who beat him all the more. Finally, at the age of 20, he managed to escape. He went to the North. He helped to organize the Underground Railroad, which freed slaves from their fate. He worked with the early women's movement and stood on stage with white women and black women in the United States that they might one day receive suffrage. He spoke from the pulpit of the Metropolitan African Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. I was there 2 weeks ago, and in a moment I stepped into that pulpit and stood behind it before I realized the greatness of those who have stood there before me, Frederick Douglass, Eleanor Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., and others. And I felt ashamed that I would presume to stand in such a holy place, and I felt some calling that is deeper in me than the one I already know. David gathered 5 smooth stones. 5 smooth stones are still lying there for all of us to pick up, if we will. Choose from among them. 2 Corinthians lays out their nature for us. Purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, holiness of spirit, a genuine love, truthful speech, the power of God. Pick the stone that feels right in your hand. The money is on Goliath, but the stone is in the sling. Pride Month is a time of gatherings around the port of this city. Celebrants know the weight and the challenges of unfinished business in the LGBTQ community. There is joy and sorrow there today. There's delight and rage there. There is friendship and there is disaffection and disagreement over many of the social issues we face. And beneath the rainbow flag is the diversity of a living nation, a living people. And today the parade is actually the boat pushing off from the harbor wall, and it's going to cross the harbor and go along Bloor Street and turn down Young Street. And then tomorrow and the next day, it will venture out beyond the safety of the cheering crowds into the larger city. And there the prevailing winds, be they for or against it, will blow, and they will feel it on the boat. The confrontation goes on. But when the storm comes and the intolerance of difference raises its ugly head, we are to take heart. We have the expected one sleeping like a baby in the back of our boat. The storms shall be calmed, the voyage shall proceed. The money may be on Goliath, but the experience of the quest is buried deep within us. We have seen a sword pulled from a stone. We have seen a weapon of truth rising from the mystery of a lake, handed to us because we are the chosen ones. We have seen an arrow split an arrow in an English castle courtyard. Put your money on that. James Russell Lowell wrote a small poem called A Stanza on Freedom. This is what he wrote. They are slaves who fear to speak for the fallen and the weak. They are slaves who will not choose hatred, scoffing, and abuse rather than in silence shrink from the truth they needs must think. They are slaves who dare not be in the right with two or three. Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the wild animals of the field, cried Goliath. And David replied, you come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord. Put your money on the Lord.